Welcome to Open Your Eyes, a podcast about empowering each of us with the perspective and tools to grow and change. I hope you're having a wonderful day. For me, the start to a great day is finding uplifting podcasts to help me with a better mindset each day. And I hope Open Your Eyes does that for you. There's just something empowering about getting your mind right before each day and week. So today, wherever you are as you listen to this podcast, I hope you can get a new perspective of how to think and live better. And if you enjoy this podcast, please take a minute to share it with a friend. Let's get started. Recently, I was reading a series of essays from an insightful author. People were asked, "What is the most liberating thought that you've ever had?" And the author shared a long list of these liberating thoughts. And we all have had times in our life when something, an idea, a thought, a concept, has changed the way we think and live. So I thought this was a really fun idea. And so for today's podcast, I'd like to pass on a number of these liberating thoughts from what I read and what I've heard from others. Before I do, let me ask you, as you consider your own life, what's been one of the most helpful thoughts or epiphanies that you've had that has made you more free or empowered to act? Now, an epiphany is to experience a moment of sudden, dramatic realization or understanding that changes your perspective or gives you new clarity. So let's explore a few. The first is this simple but powerful liberating thought, and it's this: what you focus on expands. Recently, my chief of staff went through a difficult battle with cancer. She endured chemo, radiation, and surgery, and I watched her during this time. Her focus was not on her challenge. She focused on getting better, yes, but it wasn't her daily focus. Instead, I saw her focus on what's next in life. She emerged with this intense focus to make the most of life, and this focus gave her courage she hadn't had before. With it, she went on to get her executive MBA. And this focus has expanded her life, her network, her thinking beyond anything previous before. She's learning, and most of all, learning that she can be much more than she thought possible. Her goals are no longer to be a chief of staff, but to be a leader in the organization of her choice. She says, in a sense, "What I went through made me who I am. What I'm going through will make me what I will be. What I choose to put my focus toward will now create that person. I decide my direction. My circumstances don't." Her focus has expanded her life. And if I were to ask you what your prevailing focus is right now in your life, what would be your answer? If you have a focus, I'm certain that if you organize your life around that focus, it will expand and return great things for you. Conversely, if we focus on problems or challenges, they also expand. You see, our thoughts, energy, and attention have a way of magnifying the very things we dwell upon. When our focus is on problems, those problems grow larger in our minds, shaping our outlook and behaviors. And conversely, when we fix our focus on solutions, opportunities, and strengths, those too begin to multiply. This principle applies in relationships, careers, health, and personal development. The lens through which we look often determines not only what we see, but also what tends to grow in our life. Psychologists have long studied this concept, the concept of attentional bias, the idea that our minds are drawn towards certain stimuli at the expense of others. When someone focuses on negative experiences, they become more fully attuned to further negativity. For example, a person convinced that their day is going badly will likely notice every small frustration, missing opportunities for gratitude and joy. On the other hand, focusing on progress or optimism builds resilience and momentum. In essence, our focus works like a spotlight. Whatever it shines on becomes more prominent and influential in shaping our life. Jim was born in Toronto and grew up in Ontario. His childhood was scarred. At times, his family struggled to make ends meet. They were even homeless for a while, living in a Volkswagen van while Jim's father looked for employment. Finally, his dad found a bookkeeping job for the local tire factory in town. Jim dropped out of school on his 16th birthday. You see, a year earlier, he had worked with his father to put together a stage comedy act. He had been obsessed with doing impressions. At age 10, he'd written a letter to Carol Burnett, suggesting she consider him for a role on her show. Well, he got a standard form letter in reply. His first try at comedy at Yuck Yuck's Club was a disaster. So much so that Jim returned to being a security guard with his brother at the tire factory. But this felt incongruent with his dream. So he adopted a new focus, and it was a committed focus. He worked on his act and eventually faced his fears and went back to Yuck Yuck's. And with a new act and a new attitude, he started to do well on open mic nights. He then tried out for NBC's Saturday Night Live, but wasn't selected. But he didn't lose his focus, and he kept his focus, and that expanded his opportunities and led him to decide to move to Hollywood. It was far from smooth sailing. He had little money, got little attention, and the acting roles he sought didn't materialize, but he kept his focus. Jim Carrey used to park his car on Mulholland Drive in Los Angeles every night and give himself a pep talk. In this pep talk, he used to tell himself that directors loved him, people he admired respected him, and he was going to be famous. He would leave each night feeling a bit better and with power to charge forward the next day. "I have roles," he would tell himself. "They're out there. I just don't have a hold of them yet." At one point, Jim decided to write himself a check for $10 million for acting services rendered and post-dated it Thanksgiving 1995. He kept the check in his wallet. Then, after getting noticed on a program that was broadcast nationwide in Canada, Jim got a main role on a sitcom being developed for NBC. And as part of the promotional tour, he did his act on The Tonight Show. This led to a role on a TV show called In Living Color. But about that time, Morgan Creek Productions was developing a comedy script named Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. They approached Rick Moranis about playing the role. He declined. They approached two more actors who turned them down. They changed the lead role to a woman and tried to recruit Whoopi Goldberg. The same result. Then, a producer noticed Jim on the TV show In Living Color, and he was eventually cast in the role. His performance made the film a success, and his focus kept expanding. Then, based on his performance, Jim Carrey was cast in The Mask. Soon, movies like Dumb and Dumber, Batman, Liar Liar, and The Truman Show, Bruce Almighty, and others would follow. By the way, in 1994, a year before the date of his post-dated check in his wallet, he earned $5 million for The Mask and $7 million to appear in Dumb and Dumber. Now, his story illustrates the compounding power of focus. By continually expanding his mental picture of success, Carrey aligned his decisions, efforts, and resilience to match that vision. And we may not all be Hollywood actors, but the principle applies to our everyday lives. If we focus on what frustrates us in our jobs, our dissatisfaction expands until work feels unbearable. If instead we focus on areas where we can contribute, grow, and make a difference, our sense of purpose expands. Similarly, in relationships, focusing on another's personal flaws magnifies irritation, while focusing on their strengths and positive qualities fosters appreciation. Okay, our next liberating thought. Brianna Weist wrote, "There's a measurable joy in the small things. In a great book, fresh vegetables, a warm bed, a hug. These things in our twisted world are rarely valued, but in the end, they're probably the most joy we're going to have. We find a different level of peace and joy in our life when we savor the small moments in life." Now, in the last year of my life, this is one epiphany that has changed my life. I recently took all 23 people in my family to Disney. Disneyland with 12 young grandchildren is not always peaceful or even fun at times, but it was filled with so much joy in small things that I savored. Our 3-year-old granddaughter played in the ocean for the first time in her life. It was a magical time as she challenged the waves. My autistic grandson, who usually struggles with crowds and is obsessed with Lightning McQueen, had pure joy on his face when Lightning and his friends passed by in the light parade. Our entire family wasn't watching the parade, but instead we were watching his face, and it brought several of us to tears. It's true, isn't it, that we don't remember the years that come and go in our life, but we do remember the moments. Okay, here's another epiphany. Years ago, I was reading a book, and the author quoted Brian Tracy. This quote has had a huge impact on my thinking. The quote's rather mundane, but I wrote it down and memorized it. It doesn't have clever cadence or wording, but it is profound nonetheless. He said, "Successful people have very clear goals. They know who they are and what they want. They write them down and make plans for their accomplishment." I don't know what happened as I read this rather straightforward quote, but it had a tremendous impact on me at the time. I realized that unless I planned for the reaching of my goals, having goals were of little benefit. For example, let's say I have a goal to lose 20 pounds. When I reduce it to clear plans to reach that goal, that's when it becomes powerful. So I started to lead my teams with this simple concept. Yes, we can hold goals, but what is the plan to making those goals come to life? About that time, I was teaching business strategy at a major business school, and I added to the curriculum of the course three classes spent with the students on identifying their goals for life and then making a strategy and plan for reaching those goals. And I've had many students since reach back out to me to let me know that this was the most impactful learning they had in their business school time. Now, what about you? Do you have clear goals? What plans do you have in place to reach those goals? And if not, just try this simple principle. Make those plans and watch, the progress that you make towards those goals will be significantly more. Next epiphany. I was sitting in a large audience listening to a speaker one day, and the topic of her message was just try. At the time, I was really struggling. I was struggling in my life as a father and at work. I had hit a headwind in almost every front, and this simple message changed everything for me. I walked away realizing that I didn't have to be perfect, that life was going to be full of headwinds, but I just had to keep trying. Now, I don't know what your circumstances are today. You may not feel like you're good enough in your business. You are. What you have to do, though, is show up and keep trying. And over time, you will see success. When you were younger and your mom made you practice the piano, you made lots of mistakes. But just because you made a mistake, you didn't quit playing or practicing. When you started playing, it wasn't expected that you'd be perfect. When learning the piano, there weren't just two options, perform at Carnegie Hall or quit. No, there was time for trying and practice. Because growth and development takes time. Learning takes time, even in your business or family. That's why you keep trying. Your business, your parenting, your personal habits are all the same. Don't quit. Keep trying. That is where the magic is. And here's the thing. If you feel inadequate and you're tossed about by false insecurity, feeling like you fall short and you set a goal and don't reach it, realize that this is, in fact, normal. The blessings will come into your life when you don't quit. Try. Reenlist in the cause. You have an opportunity that others don't have. And who knows if you aren't here for a real reason? And the test is not whether you reach your goals in one burst of energy, but the test is to see if you will stay in the game and just try. Okay, next liberating thought. I don't have to adopt other people's problems as my own to help them. In leadership, management, and even family life, one of the most common challenges people face is the tendency to take on responsibilities that don't belong to them. This idea is captured in the classic metaphor from William Onken and David Wass's Harvard Business Review article called "Management Time, Who Gets the Monkey?" The monkey represents a problem or a task or responsibility. And when someone comes to you with an issue, sometimes we accept ownership of it. When we do that, we've allowed their monkey to jump from their back to ours. Suddenly, instead of empowering others to solve their own problems, we are weighed down by their responsibilities. And the result is stress, inefficiency, and frustration. Now, monkeys come in many forms. Unfinished assignments, unresolved conflicts, forgotten deadlines, or worries that others pass off rather than address themselves. And the challenge isn't that people intentionally dump their monkeys on others. It often happens subtly. An employee might say, "What should I do about this?" And instead of coaching them to think through solutions, a manager might respond, "I'll take care of it." The intention is good. It seems faster and easier, but the result is that the monkey now lives on the manager's back. And over time, managers or parents, teachers or friends who continually take on other people's monkeys end up overloaded. Their own priorities are neglected while those around them remain dependent rather than growing independent. I've learned that parents who are task-oriented tend to take the monkey off the backs of their kids. They do this in the spirit of being efficient, but kids who can easily pass their monkeys to their efficient parents never learn to deal with those monkeys themselves. When Howard Schultz returned to Starbucks in 2008 during a major downturn, he realized that he'd been carrying too many monkeys. In the early years, Schultz wanted to make every decision himself about store layouts, marketing campaigns, and new product ideas. The company grew quickly, but the weight of so many monkeys slowed innovation and burned out leaders. When he came back as CEO after stepping away for several years, he changed his approach. He began insisting that decisions should be made at the lowest competent level, and he required his managers to own their outcomes rather than handing them back to Schultz. By refusing to carry every monkey, Schultz freed himself to focus on strategy and culture. This shift helped Starbucks recover from decline and expand globally once again. And this leads us to a very important principle. You push decision-making to the lowest competent level. Sometimes organizations want perfect uniformity, such as decisions made by anyone, say, at the director level. But Schultz learned to delegate to the lowest competent level. So you may be leading a business. That doesn't mean that every senior director in your organization gets the same responsibility. It depends on their competency. The principle is simple. Never accept responsibility that rightfully belongs to someone else. That doesn't mean you refuse to help them. It just means you don't accept their monkey on your back. This helps you protect your own priorities, empower others, and build accountability. Next, liberating thought. In her book, Brianna Weiss wrote this epiphany: "I am infinite. People always say, what would you do if you could live forever? Well, I'm here to say, if you believe your soul is eternal, you can. What are you doing with it now?" Now, this is an incredibly liberating thought. If you believe that after you die, you take your soul, what you've learned, what you've become, your strengths and weaknesses, on to the next life, then you feel like this life is a time to invest in making you who you will be for eternity. George's story began in December of 1943 when, as a 21-year-old Army private in basic training at Camp Barkley, Texas, he began to feel sick and run a fever, so he went to the infirmary. He was anxious to do whatever he could do to reduce the fever and returned to his company as quickly as possible, but the fever grew and got worse. First 102, then 103, then it was 106 degrees. He was taken to the emergency room, and once there, he passed out. When he came to, he stood up and noticed someone else was lying in his bed. It was so strange. But he had this sense that he needed to look for himself, for his own body. So he went from bunk to bunk until he finally found himself. There he was, lying lifeless in a cot in the infirmary. He then realized he had died. As he sat there next to his body, he didn't know what to do. He didn't know what this meant, and he didn't know where to go. As he started to deal with this new reality, a light entered the room. It was an extremely bright light, but it was more than that. It was a person of light, and he realized he was in the presence of the Lord. He felt not heard, but felt the words, "Stand up," and he did. He felt something emanating from this being of light, and it was love. It was unconditional love. Then he started to remember. He remembered the events of his life, from the time he was born to his childhood to the events of his teenage years. Those events were filled with those closest to him. He said every detail of 20 years of living was there to be looked at, the good, the bad, the high points, the run of the mill. And with this all-inclusive view came a question. It was implicit in every scene and seemed to proceed from the living light standing beside him. The question was, what did you do with your life? He knew that the being already knew the answer, but the question was for George to answer. As George made a list of things he had done, like become an Eagle Scout, the being said, "That glorified you." And George searched even deeper for the things he did to glorify others or God. And suddenly, George realized that had he known this question, this way of being measured in life, is what happened when he died, he would have done things differently. "Someone should have told me," he said. And the answer back was, "I tried to tell you, I even showed you." George then travels to a number of different places. In the first scene, he sees a group of workers gathered around a fire. A woman was standing with them, and she seemed to be ignored by the others. As they passed a cigarette around, she reached eagerly for a cigarette but was unable to grip it. George realized that when you pass from this life, you take with you the feelings, the cravings, the focus that made you, that existed when you lived in this life. And he realized that among the living on the earth were beings, spirits, of those who had passed, and they were stuck there living out of their desires, but unable to act on those desires. He visited a bar where some of the beings there continually reached for drinks, but couldn't grasp them. He saw another group where angry people were yelling and striking each other, but unable to hit or make contact with others. To his mind came the scripture he learned as a boy. "Lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." George wondered why the spirits who wanted to smoke or drink or fight or any other type of desire seemed to group together. What he soon realized was that in his realm, his thoughts were not private, that others knew your thoughts and behaviors, and these spirits grouped together with others with whom they were comfortable. He was then taken to a great campus. There on the campus, amazing work was being done, discoveries, advanced science education, and work beyond his comprehension. There, the works of the worlds and universes beyond his comprehension was being done by those who had passed from this life. His overarching impression was that these beings were continuing to learn and grow. He said he saw a glowing, seemingly endless city, bright enough to be seen all over the unimaginable distance between. The brightness seemed to shine from the very walls and streets of this place. Then everything changed and closed and narrowed for George, and he returned to his body. As he opened his eyes, he was back on his cot in the hospital. George later learned that he had died and been dead for 9 minutes. A boy working in the ward had returned to George's body to prepare it for the morgue when he felt George's hand move. He ran and got the supervisor and convinced the supervisor to give a shot of adrenaline into George's heart. The supervisor did, and this would eventually revive George, and it would take some time, but George would recover from pneumonia. George Ritchie's book, Return from Tomorrow, aptly illustrates the very fact that our souls do not end when we leave this life, but rather who we are, what we've done, continues with us. This liberating thought has a very powerful impact on what choices we make and where we choose to spend our time. When we sometimes feel selfish for improving ourselves, it's okay. What we're doing is building us for eternity. Okay, the next liberating thought. I get to choose what I think about. Now, this seems simple, but it is incredibly liberating when you fully embrace it. In today's sometimes toxic social media culture, we forget we get to choose. We can all choose to think faithfully, to think about the good that's in the world, to think about giving grace to others. This was the message of Governor Spencer Cox speaking on Meet the Press after the killing of Charlie Kirk. He was incredibly profound. He said, "We can change our approach to our country. But that starts with each of us choosing what to think. He said a president or a governor or anyone else can't change what we think. That's up to us. We are free to choose for ourselves, and we can choose grace. We can choose to do good. You get to choose. Each day when the alarm goes off, it's your choice. No force or feeling can keep you from choosing. Mel Robbins tells the story of her change and her choice. She was in debt. She was depressed. Her usual routine in the morning was to push the snooze alarm until her kids woke up to take them to the bus stop. She was constantly depressed, but one day she was watching a television clip of a rocket launch, and she had an epiphany. She could launch out of bed before the anxiety of the day and depression set in that would take away her choice to get up quickly. So the next morning, when the alarm went off, she counted 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 and launched up and acted before the habit and feeling hampered her choice. This led her to other choices in her life. We always have a choice. We get to choose what we think about. And like Mel, we can focus on acting. There's one gift that God has given to us that is perhaps the most powerful of all. He's given to us the right to choose. We have agency. This protected freedom allows us to choose where we go and who we become. Don't let some social media frenzy cause you to think something without giving away your agency. Don't give into the feelings. Remember, you're free to choose what to think, and you are independent from others, and you're also independent from temporary feelings. Let me say this. If you're facing challenges, if you have a habit that's lingering, if you don't know if you can overcome something or reach some goal that you're seeking, you can choose each day to change or do. Maybe you will fail today, but that doesn't dictate tomorrow. You can choose again tomorrow, and that choice over and over again will slowly lead you to the liberating actions you need to be set free. Don't stop choosing. I have faith that you'll prevail. Okay, last liberating thought of the day. There is always a way, even when it feels like there isn't. There is always a way. There are different jobs, new ideas, new people coming into your life. Keep the faith. You can do what you set out to do. Keep your faith. Don't give it away. Don't give it away to people who doubt you, to discouraging thoughts, or to anything else. You can, you will, and you'll find exactly what you choose to focus on. So as we end today, hold on to these liberating thoughts and to the other liberating thoughts you've had in your life. Write them down, commit to them, and let them work to help you become that remarkable person you're trying to become. And watch, you will take to the end of this life and into the next a person that you can be proud of. Most of all, thanks for being here today. And don't forget to share this podcast with a friend and join us next week for another podcast as we learn to open our eyes to who and what we can become.